from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. As a former U.S. State Department official, Anya Manuel was deeply involved in developing U.S. policy toward Afghanistan and Pakistan. Coming up on Forum, we talk to her about the global fight against terrorism in light of the Orlando mass shootings. And we'll also talk with Manuel, who is now a Stanford lecturer, about her new book, This Brave New World, India, China, and the United States. Forum up ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Anya Manuel served in the United States State Department with responsibility for South Asia policy from 2005 to 2007. She is co-founder and partner with former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley, and Secretary of Defense Robert Gates in the strategic consulting firm Rice Hadley Gates LLC. A graduate of Stanford and Harvard Law School, she lectures at Stanford, and she recently published a book focusing on relations between the United States, China, and India called This Brave New World. We're going to talk about the book, but I ought to mention also that at the State Department, she was extensively involved in developing U.S. policy toward Afghanistan and Pakistan. So I want to begin by talking to her about global terrorism and the Orlando attacks, and welcome, Anya Manuel. Good to have you back with us.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Found a article you did, actually an editorial in the New York Times, where you said we're not going to solve this ISIS, ISIL, Daesh problem until the civil war in Syria is somehow resolved. Still pretty much hold to that.
I do feel like that's actually the case. ISIS and ISIL is a terrorist group. We've been having a lot of debate in the United States about whether it's Islamic terrorism and radical Islamic terrorism. The point here is that you can't antagonize an entire religion of 1.6 billion Muslims in the world. 2.75 million Muslims live in the United States. You're not going to build a wall to keep all of them out. We have to find a way to get along. But the longer this war in Syria and Iraq festers, the more difficult it is to do something about terrorist groups like ISIL.
Did the United States make a mistake by saying that Assad has to be removed? Because to some degree, Assad has been maybe not as tough with ISIS, some would argue, as he could have been, but they're his enemy too.
Boy, there are no good solutions to this conflict at all. We did say, I think now 4 years ago, that Assad must go. I think the question is not whether we should have said that or not, but once we've said it, we should have acted on it.
Well, red line could have been acted on too, but it wasn't. I mean, there are pragmatic sides to this whole argument as well. It's multidimensional and, as you say, rather difficult to decide upon. But now ISIS is spreading its tentacles. I mean, it's stronger in Libya than it's ever been before. And you also have come out very strongly in favor of supporting the present Iraqi regime also as a wedge against ISIS.
I haven't actually come out in favor of supporting the present Iraqi regime. I think what I said in that article, which was several years ago, is that you can't solve – this is a multidimensional, very complex problem. We initially were mostly staying out of it. Then belatedly, we sent some advisors in and tried to arm what we thought were the good groups in Syria. I believe that that was the right policy, but we enacted it about 2 years too late. So a lot of the what we would call the good guys were no longer alive. And at the same time, when we enacted that policy, we hadn't done very much in Iraq. We're changing that now. So our military strategy in Iraq is stronger than I think it's ever been. I believe that Secretary of Defense Carter is doing quite a good job there. But it hasn't quite been coupled with a political strategy. And political strategies in Iraq are difficult, difficult, difficult.
I keep hearing the importance of bringing the Baathists or the Sunnis back into Iraqi government, but there seems to be ongoing resistance to that. And now we find ourselves fighting alongside the Revolutionary Guard to try to take Mosul back from essentially ISIL.
I mean,
it's, again, a really weird configuration of alliances and misalliances and so forth. And it It brings me actually to your book, too, because there seems to be a danger in your mind with these two extraordinarily developing powers, India and China, and the alliance between those two, as opposed to an axis between, say, Pakistan and and China, which is quite strong.
Yes, it is interesting because our attention as a country and especially as an administration, it keeps getting torn back to the Middle East because that's where the immediate crises are coming from. My book argues that the most dramatic impact on the United States now and in a decade from now are the two largest growing powers on Earth. So China and India will have a dramatic impact on all of us here, and we need to pay a lot of attention to them.
I was amazed at how much China is involved in Pakistan. I mean, to the tune of about $46 billion investment in military exercises and building nuclear reactors and arming them to the teeth, as they used to say. I mean, this is pretty serious, but to put it mildly. But China, as opposed to perhaps what Trump has been trumpeting, you know, may not be the biggest thing we have to fear in this part of the world. In many respects, it's not only the other Mideastern countries, it's also our alliance with India, which at present under Modi seems to have some strength to it, but is vulnerable.
It does have some strength to it. And the great thing about the India-U.S. growing strategic partnership is that it is truly bipartisan. So Bill Clinton did a very famous trip to India at the end of his administration. George W. Bush really doubled down with the civilian nuclear deal that I helped negotiate just about 10 years ago. And President Obama has made India really a big piece of his administration. The reason these two are important, both China and India, and I would argue that even though the alliance with India is getting stronger, India just doesn't get as much attention in our public discourse as China does. There are headlines about China constantly, and we seem not to know quite what we think about it. One day they're 10 feet tall and they're coming to get us, and the next day it's five signs of the Chinese economic apocalypse and they're all falling apart. So I argue for a much more measured policy that looks at both of these giants and looks at what we can all do to get along together, because we must.
Which makes good sense and seems wise. However, you mentioned President Clinton, former President Bill Clinton. He once came out with a statement that since we started talking about the Middle East, he said there is one place that's almost nearly as volatile as the Middle East, and that would have to be the Pakistan-India, I mean, over Kashmir and over so many other things. And now here's this alliance between China and Pakistan and a growing alliance.
Mm-hmm. Well, the background of the China-Pakistan alliance is very long. So China has been a consistent partner, good partner to Pakistan since really China came into existence in the late 1940s. And I think we should not be entirely negative on this alliance. We should watch it carefully. But let me tell you what I see as the positives in this. So China is its lifeline is the ocean. It brings in most of its goods through the ocean on the east coast of China. And the west of China really has very little access to the sea. So of course it needs to partner with Pakistan. They're building a big port in Gwadar where you can see Chinese construction workers. They've been there for 5-7 years. They've built a first-class port, and now they're building the rail lines and the highways across the Himalayas to bring goods into and out of China.
There's also a lot of military activity right on the border of the Himalayas. I mean, and there is some enmity there that's clear. I'm just wondering about what China wants out of this. In addition to a short route for oil, isn't there talk about a secret agenda of military foothold in the Indian Ocean?
I don't think it's a secret agenda. I think it's very open. China doesn't have too many natural allies. If you look at India, it's more and more closely partnering with the West. If you look at the U.S. and Europe, there is a natural partnership there. China pretty much stands on its own. It trumpets a lot its relationship with Russia, and they attend each other's military parades, and Putin and President Xi make a big deal out of their partnership. But it's not nearly as strong as you would expect. There was a big gas deal between China and Russia several years ago, but the price was never disclosed. And we think that's because the Chinese got themselves a very, very good deal on Russian gas. And so it's natural for China to look for partners, and Pakistan is one of the very few partners. I have to say, though, in a real conflict, I think Pakistan is not a particularly helpful partner to have.
If you've just joined us, we're talking with Anya Emanuel, and she is co-founder and principal of Rice Hadley Gates, which is a strategic consulting firm. She's also the author of a new book called This Brave New World, India, China, and the United States. There is a kind of polemic in your book, call it a central idea, that we need, the United States needs to not only form better relationship with not only China and India, but to help a better relationship between China and India. I mean, that's really what you're arguing here. And yet I bring up all this other stuff because it's in the way.
Absolutely. It's both. You need the whole triangle of relations to be positive, and it's for all our benefits. And let me say a word about that. China and India matter to us because by 2030, there will be 3 billion people between them. They will be the fastest growing markets for our companies, and we will be selling to them. We also need them to solve the world's biggest problems. So we used to believe that, for example, we could solve climate change if just the U.S. and Europe got along and decided what to do about it. That is no longer the case. China is the world's largest carbon emitter. We're here in San Francisco. 20% of California's smog actually floats right over from Asia. And India is the world's fastest growing carbon emitter. So for this and other problems, we absolutely need to find a way to get the whole triangle of relations right.
You mentioned the environmental problems, and they are at the center. We've also got, to contend with the fact that we've got the Security Council here as well in terms of making policy, but economics also. I mean, as you point out in your book, this plays a central role in what needs to be done to foster better relations.
Yes, and you've heard a lot in the campaign trail, a lot of anti-China rhetoric, especially from Trump and to some extent from Bernie Sanders. I believe that Trump is wrong on China, and what he wants to do is not in our interest.
So, well, it's a tax the hell out of him, basically.
Yeah, he has said that he wants to slap a 45% tariff on Chinese goods. Now, normally, when you do that to a country, they're likely to retaliate. They're not going to sit still. And China is currently the fastest export market for our goods. They are doing some things that we need to push back on. So there's not an even playing field for foreign companies in the Chinese market. We should push back on that through the WTO and through other methods, as we are already doing. But shutting our economy to them, unfortunately, won't bring the blue-collar jobs back that we've lost. And it just shoots ourselves in the foot. Let me give you one example. Boeing, which manufactures its planes in the United States, ships over a quarter of its commercial aircraft to China and India alone. If Chinese market is closed to us, just Boeing alone estimates that it would have to lay off tens of thousands of American workers.
Well, you also mentioned the creation of jobs. To a great extent, you know, more trade and more dealing with both the Chinese and India means more jobs for Americans, even though there's a lot of outsourcing and there's been a great deal of outcry about the outsourcing. I wonder, though, about when you're talking about pushback, what about pushing back on hacking? You seem to want to take maybe a more modest approach to that with the Chinese.
The Chinese cyber spying on U.S. companies is unprecedented in world history, and it's a problem, and it needs to stop. And I think it's great that President Obama got really serious about this before the summit with Xi Jinping in September of 2015. The Chinese have now gotten the message, and they've said they are working on it. The difficult thing here is no one quite knows where this is coming from. So the Chinese would argue that this isn't state-sponsored, that is private hackers, and to some extent that's true. When you've seen some of the research on it, a lot of these guys who are stealing our industrial secrets are folks who work for the Chinese government by day, but then moonshine at night for private parties. And so it's a little bit complicated. I think we are now doing exactly the right thing. We have made it clear to the Chinese how serious we are about this. We have an ongoing dialogue where we are pushing them to be better. The point I made in the book was just that the United States I think 2 years ago, indicted 6 Chinese hackers for cyber spying. And that's not going to make any difference because they're never going to be extradited here. And there's nothing we're going to be able to do about that.
So when you argue for better relations between the United States and China and the United States and India, it's in our own self-interest. And it's also in our own self-interest, you argue, to have better relations and to essentially foster better relations between India and China.
Absolutely.
That's kind of the bottom line here, isn't it?
It is.
So the scenario that you work out in the book is 2030. By the year 2030, it can either be another Cold War going on or we can have accord and we can have comity and all the things that you're talking about.
Yes, I hope we move to the positive trajectory. But let me pick up on your question about how China and India get along, because this is something that doesn't really get a lot of attention in our press. They say a lot about what good partners they are. And I think India sees China much like we see China. So it's a very important trading relationship, India's most important trading relationship. It's unbalanced, just like the U.S.-China trade relationship is unbalanced. The Indians don't want to stop trading with the Chinese. They need it. But on the other hand, they're worried as China becomes increasingly assertive and pushes its power southward and towards the West into what was India's traditional sphere of influence. So let me give you some examples. If you look at YouTube, there are videos of Chinese and Indian soldiers punching each other. They're not allowed to shoot, and no one's been killed yet, luckily. But they have a long border up in the high Himalayas where there is basically nothing, no roads, nothing. The Chinese are building a lot of roads and outposts up there, and some of them, the Indians would argue, lots of incursions into Indian territory. That has the Indians worried. In addition, Chinese submarines are increasingly what one Indian admiral told me, sneaking close to India's coasts in the Indian Ocean. And it has the Indian military quite worried.
So what do we do? Since this is in our common interest to foster better relations between the Chinese and the Indians, what's the role for the United States here?
Our role is to be very – two things. One, it's to be very clear and consistent about where our lines are and enforce them. For example, we have recently restarted freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea. I think that is a good thing because China claims this vast area of the sea, what they call the nine-dash line. It's basically thousands of miles out from their own coasts. It doesn't stand the test of international law. So we should push back on that, and we should push back on other countries' claims if they're unreasonable. But we've been inconsistent. So we did those freedom of navigation operations for a while. Then we stopped for 5 years, and now we've started again. And if I'm the Chinese military, I'm a little bit confused about where the rules are and what we're going to enforce. So we need to be clear and consistent, and as much as possible, I would say, keep it out of the news. This is very difficult in today's environment, but you have BBC and CNN and journalists flying around with our military reporting in real time. That is a very difficult thing, especially for the Chinese. You need to keep this conflict low and you need to allow them to save face. So clear and consistent. But secondly, and the most important thing we can do is to cooperate with them in every possible way we can. So that starts with dialogues to make sure that there are no accidents on the high seas. Some of those are starting and ongoing. It also includes things like creative ways to cooperate that we haven't before. For example, the 2014 deal between the United States and China to combat climate change, I thought was a really positive thing. If you're not a diplomat, you always assume that getting along with foreign countries is something that happens as a matter of course, but it's actually something that needs to be practiced. So when I was working in the State Department—
It's the art of diplomacy.
Really. It's the art of diplomacy, and it's not so easy, and it requires work. When India and the United States negotiated the civilian nuclear deal, boy, those negotiations were so contentious, and they were so difficult, and it would have been very easy for both sides to throw in the towel. But we didn't. We came up with an accord that's imperfect but is a vast improvement over what was there before. And it unlocked all sorts of other cooperation because it taught us how to work together. And that's what I argue for between all three countries.
Well, aside from the fact that we owe an incredible amount of money to the Chinese and are in debt to them, we now have, as we alluded to before, much better relations with India under Modi, who at one point was not even allowed in this country and now came here to speak to the U.S. Congress. Does China see something like that, do you think, as maybe a menace or a threat to their relationship with the United States, the growing continued, call it amity, between the United States and India?
They do. And this is a classic security dilemma. So as China becomes more assertive, some would say aggressive, the other smaller countries in the region are realigning. Vietnam, which was not a friend of the United States for decades, now wants us back. We've just lifted an arms embargo. We're going to be selling military gear to Vietnam. The Philippines wants us back. India and the United States have a very close military partnership in a way that you couldn't have imagined a decade or two decades ago. And all these countries see it as a reaction to what China is doing. China sees these actions and feels even more surrounded and even more isolated.
Yeah, but by the same token, China is extending itself in the region, giving more aid to just about every country around them. I mean, whereas, in fact, you make a kind of fascinating analysis in your book about how India is much more altruistic, let's say. And there again is a kind of ideological divide between the Chinese who feel it's in their interest to have more, call it hegemony maybe, in the region by aiding and assisting, as in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. Chinese aid is absolutely unique. I don't think we've really seen this in the history of the world before. Last year, China invested over $180 billion abroad. The U.S. did $350 billion, but that's really a lot for an up-and-coming country. And as you alluded to, the One Belt, One Road initiative, which is really the centerpiece of this in China, is unprecedented in that they're using aid, trade, and loans, and their state-owned enterprises really in a joint effort. So the way the United States gives aid or India or Europe, we give some aid through our government, usually not as much as society thinks we do. We give a few loans, and then our companies invest wherever they think there are good investments. China does it all as one comprehensive policy, and that's the important thing to understand. So you said before, and you're right, that China is giving $46 billion in aid to Pakistan. Yes, that's what was announced. But actually, most of that money, if it materializes, are loans to Chinese state-owned enterprises that will then come in and build the roads and the electricity plants and the coal mines and the railroads. So it's not like giving money directly to another country.
We're talking with Anya Manuel, and I want to talk with her also about the problems within China and India, particularly the factory towns, which she writes about in China, and the slums of Delhi. And there's lots to talk about in general. She certainly served this country in this part of the world and also in the part of the world that's come up again in the wake of Orlando, Afghanistan, and it was an American Afghan, in fact, who was behind what happened. And I read in Facebook, Khalid Husseini, our friend, the novelist, wrote about just how much suffering is being felt in the American Afghan community because of this. Anyway, feel free to join us. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Anya Manuel this hour, co-founder and principal of Rice Hadley Gates, a strategic consulting firm and author of This Brave New World, India, China, and the United States. She served in the United States State Department from 2005 to 2007 and is presently a lecturer at Stanford. And we spoke with her about the importance of partnerships not only between the United States, India, and China, but also a growing and better relationship between China and India and how important that is to the United States. And you may indeed want to weigh in here. There's lots to weigh in about. We've been talking about trade and also about the importance of working together with China and India against environmental degradation and climate change. And also the whole concern about, military foothold that China wants in the Indian Ocean, the borders that it shares with India, and the concern that India may have indeed about a growing relationship between China and Pakistan. There are a lot of pieces to this puzzle as we speak about it. It's a geopolitical multidimensional puzzle. And we do welcome your responses and your thoughts and any questions you might have. Let me tell you again how you can join the program. Toll free, you can do it now, 866-733-6786. We welcome your questions, comments, and what you have to shed in the way of light on this whole conversation. Again, 866-733-6786. The importance, really, we're talking about relationships, again, between the United States and China and India, two of the great growing powers, and between India and China. You can also email your thoughts to us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And Anya Manuel will be speaking Wednesday, 6:30, at the World Affairs Council. Mentioned before I went to the break, that you do spend some time talking about the factory towns in China, the inequality, economic inequality in China, and the economic inequality in India with the slums and with a still kind of, I don't know, call it a neo-caste system. I mean, the caste system has been presumably exorcised, but there's still a great deal of poverty and pariahs, part of that poverty. I want to understand how you see this in the big picture. I mean, particularly in terms of partnerships and relationships between the United States and these two countries and between these two countries.
Sure. One of the most interesting things for me in writing the book is that I got to see a different part of China and India. Usually I go and I meet with business leaders and the government, and this allowed me to spend some time in India's slums and learning about the factory workers who assemble our phones and tablets. Poverty is still, of course, a much larger problem in India than it is in China. 300 million Indians live under the World Bank poverty line, and that's only $1.25 a day. So it's a real problem. In China, it's only 84 million. And urban poverty looks very different in both of these countries in ways that I didn't quite appreciate before. So if you see the slums of India, it's everything you imagine. People live in corrugated iron huts. There is no plumbing. There is no electricity. The streets were actually surprisingly clean because it's a very cohesive community and people take pride in their little community. And they make their living by climbing a trash heap that is 3 football fields tall every day and picking out all the materials that are recyclable, the plastic bottles and the plastic things, and selling them to recyclers. And that's important because it means they are not in the formal sector. So sometimes it's very hard for the Indian state to find these people in order to be able to help them. Now, you contrast that with China. There's still a lot of rural poverty, and there is urban poverty, but it looks different than in India. There are almost no slums like the ones you see outside of Indian cities. Instead, the migrant workers and factory workers live in factory towns. It's not pleasant. It's probably 16 people, the women that were interviewed for the book. They sleep in a dorm, 16 beds to a dorm room. But there is bathrooms, there is indoor plumbing, there is heat in the winter, there is a rec room with a ping pong table, and it just looks different. And the important difference here is they get a formal paycheck from a factory. So when the Chinese state wants to help them, as it is starting to do, to have pensions, to have maternity leave, to have real health care policies, it's easy to do that because they're in the formal sector. In India, these folks are hard to find. And it's only recently, 5 years ago, actually an Indian, one of the most successful Indian tech entrepreneurs said to the government, I'm going to take 100 of my best engineers and I'm going to create for India a state-of-the-art biometric ID system. So what you think of as our social security card, the little cardboard card we all carry around, 1 billion Indians have now voluntarily signed up to have 10 fingerprints and 2 iris scans taken. And now even the poorest in the slums can be counted and you can find them. And instead of handing out grain, half of which would disappear due to graft, now they can go to a corner store where someone has a smartphone, put in their fingerprint scan and say, I'm owed 500 rupees in pension. So it has vastly improved the system, but there is a lot for India.
Well, you mentioned graft, and in your book you also pay a good deal of attention to the corruption in both these countries, and the corruption is staggering, I mean, in both. So if we have – if we diminish the economic inequality and if we somehow reduce the corruption, it can enable better relationships, not only between these two countries, but between the United States in terms of common interests?
It can. I mean, the corruption is staggering, as you say. We've heard a lot more about Chinese corruption. And again, this is – let me give you an idea of the character of the corruption and what they're doing with it and then how it impacts our relationship. So in China, Wang Shishan, who's the now famous anti-corruption czar, sees this really as his way and President Xi's way to purify the Communist Party to rule for another century. So this is about the purity of the party. And it's been entirely top down. No one doubts that if Wang Shishan and his bureau find someone guilty, that they're going to be convicted of corruption. And they've investigated almost 200,000 people. It's a lot. It's a real crackdown. India, by contrast, is a democracy. It's been all bottom up.
Sorry, I was thinking the last crackdown like that was the Cultural Revolution.
It was. Well, the Cultural Revolution is slightly different. But this is – people always ask me –
It's vastly different.
It's vastly different. Yeah. Is it – is this entirely political or is it real? My view as an outsider is it's real. But of course, any time you are enabling people to denounce each other, it takes on a little bit of a political character. So it's a little bit of both. India has been all bottom up. So 5 years ago, there was a gentleman by the name of Anna Hazare, elderly gentleman, a little bit Gandhi-esque with his spectacles. He had finally had enough about Indian corruption, and he went on hunger strike. And thousands of Indians joined him in protesting in the streets. And what they wanted was an independent commission that would quickly prosecute cases of corruption. They didn't quite get that. They got part of it there. But they did get a new government elected, the Modi government, which ran on a clean government platform, and they've made some improvements. It's not perfect. The BJP isn't perfect, just like the Congress Party, which was in power before them, isn't perfect. But things are moving in India, and they're moving from the bottom up. Why this matters for us is because the heart of the relationship between China, India, and the U.S. is going to have to be economic. And it's very hard for our businesses to do work in China and in India as long as this corruption cloud hangs over their heads. And it's hard for China and India to become truly first world nations and first class nations until they solve this problem.
I'm going to go to your calls and emails here. Quick question, though. Your Stanford colleague and your business partner, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, was one of the few names that's been mentioned by Donald Trump when he discussed vice presidential possibilities. You think she'd be interested, or have you discussed Trump's candidacy with her? Would she endorse Trump, do you think?
I have not discussed Trump's candidacy with her, so you'll have to ask her directly. But
if she'll come on the air, I'll be glad to.
Let me predict. It's unlikely that she will be Trump's vice president.
Well, that's putting it pretty bluntly. Let me go to our callers. And again, you can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Here's Bill. Bill, you're on. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead.
She's putting a good spotlight on China and India, but she should keep in mind that China is reaching out far more than that. China actually designed, financed, and built the United Nations for the African Union in Addis Ababa. I mean, they are really, really working closely within the countries, not just giving them money.
Yeah, you're right. And in fact, Anya, you point out in your book that the Chinese are building up trade, as I said earlier, with so many other countries in the region exceeding India. I mean, you know, with Bangladesh, with Sri Lanka, with Bhutan, Nepal. I mean, it's all over the region, really. Mm-hmm.
You're absolutely right. I'm always struck by when I travel around the world, including to Latin America, Africa, what people want to talk about is China's influence on their particular country. And it's trade. So China is now the most important trading partner of 96 countries around the world. That's a lot more than have the most important trading relationship with the United States. And you're right. China is funding a lot of different things in different countries. It started out about a decade ago with, you know, the famous football stadiums for dictators and things. They have wised up since then, and they are participating a lot more in international organizations, which I think is a good thing. So China, for example, has, I think, more than doubled its contribution to the United Nations. They announced that last fall. They are contributing more to peacekeeping operations. And of course, they have created a new international institution called the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, which the United States chose not to join. We are right to be monitoring this Chinese expansion carefully. We should be watching it. However, when China does things like voluntarily constrain its own power, so they could make all of these investments alone. Instead, they're choosing to do it through the AIIB. They've invited 57 other countries to join. And the CEO of
AIIB is
the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. The CEO of that entity is going around saying, we want high labor standards, we want high environmental standards, we want to do what the World Bank has done, but we want to do it better. And we want to join with other countries in doing it. That's the kind of thing where the United States should join so we can monitor and influence China from the inside rather than staying petulantly on the outside.
Let's go back for a moment, if we could, to what we started talking about in the wake of Orlando and common interest with respect to Islamic extremism or whatever you want to call it, jihadists. I mean, the Chinese have those concerns. Obviously, the Indians have those concerns, but they're different in some ways. I mean, because of the geography and because of, you know, who's there, so to speak.
Yes.
I mean, India is concerned about Pakistan largely, I think, and that's why I brought up initially the whole Chinese-Pakistan relationship, because in some ways it would seem to me historically it would be somewhat threatening to India. But India's concerns are of a different nature with respect to Islamic radicalism or extremism, aren't they?
You're right. They are very different. And China is worried about radical Islamic terrorism, mostly with respect to their Uyghur population, which is a Muslim population that lives in the far west of China. There have been some incidents. So some people were killed at a train station. There have been stabbings. When you talk to Uyghur activists, they would argue that their people are just poor and they're not allowed to practice their religion, which is Islam, freely. The Chinese think this is really dangerous and they need to crack down. So there's two sides of every story. In India, there is real evidence that a lot of the terrorist attacks on India, like the November 26th attacks from about 8 years ago and others, are planned by terrorist groups within Pakistan, sometimes with the knowledge and even assistance of the Pakistani intelligence services, and then carried out in India as a way to needle the much stronger India. So it's very different, and it creates complications for us sometimes because the Chinese will say, well, we want to partner on anti-terrorism. And partly we think that's a good idea. Like, for example, China is playing a much more constructive role in Afghanistan than they ever have. They are giving more aid. They are trying to play a constructive role in the peace talks with the Taliban, which have now fallen apart. But we think that's a positive thing, and we want to encourage them to do that. At the same time, we don't want to use that as a cover for a Chinese crackdown on a religious minority.
You mentioned that you helped broker the deal between the United States and India, the nuclear agreement, all its contentiousness notwithstanding. You also, as I pointed out earlier, write about the nuclear reactors that have gone into China with gone into Pakistan with the help of China and nuclear weapons. I mean, the first weaponized drone, for example, now courtesy of the Chinese. I mean, is there a concern that militants will by India that militants will get a hold of some of these weapons?
Yes, Pakistan's buildup of nuclear weapons is of real concern to India and to the United States and should be to all of us.
It should be to China, too.
And should be to China, too. So the big change in Pakistan's nuclear weapons program is that recently they have started talking about battlefield nuclear weapons, which, of course, is an outrageous concept. You annihilate the entire battlefield if you use a nuclear weapon. And a lot of Pakistan's nuclear technology came from China originally. China, of course, is a member of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and it agreed not to leak its nuclear technology. India never joined the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. But to the best of our knowledge, they've never leaked their nuclear technology to anyone. So India has actually been a decent steward of this nuclear
Pakistan
technology.
Did under...
And Pakistan did, of course, under AQ.
Let me bring another caller on here, and that's Arthur from San Jose. Arthur, you're on.
Yes, great show. Thank you so much for covering this topic. Very interesting. Quick question and for clarification. From what I heard, the debt that we owe to China is actually an investment vehicle for China to stabilize currency, and actually we make a profit, a good profit from that. Is that true, or is that something you just read on the internet that's not totally correct?
It's a very good question. China, of course, owns a lot of U.S. Treasury bonds, and, you know, they get interest on those bonds, so it's an investment for them. It is a very symbiotic relationship between the U.S. Treasuries and China. That problem that we used to talk about for years where we have so much debt to China and they're artificially keeping their currency low, some of that is automatically adjusting, not completely, but a little bit because of China's economic slowdown. So where China previously was growing at 10% a year, exporting a lot of products that we were paying for and as a result had these deficits that were financed through the Chinese buying our treasuries. This stuff gets complicated. There is a little bit less of that now, and so there is more balance. I think you also asked about the currency. And this is such a bugbear always when you have a presidential election. Trump is out there saying the Chinese are currency manipulators. People said it in the 2012 election. It's no longer really true. So the Chinese renminbi, the Chinese currency, has appreciated by over 25% in the past decade. Now it's actually depreciating slightly, but that's because they have let it float more. So they've made it easier for people to trade in renminbi and they've liberalized the financial markets. And so the reason that the value of the currency is dropping a little bit is because the Chinese economy isn't doing as well.
Let me thank you, Arthur, for your call and go to some of our listener comments on the website. And you can add yours, kqed.org/forum. Chris writes, Michael Krasny said our interest is in fostering good relations between India and China. Actually, I was framing that as something that I see in the book here that our guest has as her thesis. That would be nice, this listener writes, but actually our establishment is concerned with the growth of China and its potential emergence as a regional hegemon. Therefore, our interest is to work with India and many other nations in Asia to contain China.
I agree with half of the statement. Our interest is to work with India and many other countries in the region, but it is also to work with China. And in the book, I set out two trajectories. We'll probably end up somewhere in between. But there are two real trajectories here. If you take, for example, what Trump is saying and you take it to its logical conclusion, you end up in a trade war with China. Military expenditures go up in all three countries, the U.S., India, and China. China does more things like cooperating with Pakistan on its nuclear weapons and cooperating with Russia in ways that we don't like. And before you know it, you have a new Cold War of sorts. That is not in anybody's interest.
But it's a plausible scenario.
But it is a plausible scenario. And that's, I think, where you get when your mindset in the United States is only to contain China. I think that's where we end up. There's another scenario, which is that we are not going to share our national interests with China completely. There are many things on which we will disagree, but there is enough area of commonality, our business relations back and forth, clean technology companies from the United States that are doing more work in China than anywhere else because China invests twice as much in clean technologies as the United States does, the climate change agreement, our cooperation in helping develop infrastructure in third countries. All of those things can be bases for cooperating with China while we don't pull punches when we have a real disagreement with them. And so ultimately, we can find a way to all jostle along pretty comfortably.
I want to go to more of our listener comments. But before I do, I mentioned that you talk about the economic inequality issues both in China and India. And you also write about treatment of women in both of those countries. We're talking really about what probably will be the biggest economic power nation in the world and the second, the United States, and the third, India. And you say that as far as democracies go, India probably has about the worst record where women are concerned of any of the democracies in the planet. China, of course, is not a democracy. Some would argue otherwise. But what about China's record in terms of women?
China's record on women has actually been mostly positive. So when the Communist Party came to power in the late 1940s, the equality of women was one of the major tenets. And that wasn't perfect, but there were women involved in the military with Mao when they were fighting their way out of the jungle. Women have been very, very successful in Chinese business. So some of their largest companies are actually run by women. There are 30 million Chinese female entrepreneurs and more self-made women billionaires in China than anywhere else on earth.
They were still trying to create rules, essentially, that would allow for only males to be born at one time, though. I mean, they do have that history as well.
They do. And it's unfortunate because there is this conflict between the Confucianist background of China, which is patriarchal and often seen to favor men and male heirs, and the communist system, which really was designed to be quite egalitarian. And of course, nothing's perfect. So there is a big domestic violence problem in China. There was an article about a month ago of a family whose daughter was tragically killed by her husband, and they left the coffin sitting in the living room for weeks just to draw attention to this problem. So there are real problems in China. In terms of women being economically equal and working, that's a really positive thing. And frankly, more Chinese women work than in the United States. Almost 80% of Chinese women are in the workforce and 58% in the U.S. and only 25% in India.
Just get back to corruption for a moment, though, too, because you do write about women and their role in both societies as well as the cultural backgrounds. And I mean, the book is quite ambitious in this sense. And the corruption in both countries, so much seems to be contingent in terms of necessity for reform in India with respect to corruption. But China is pervasively corrupt in different ways. I mean, just reading, do you know the author Hajin? Just reading Hajin, for example, you realize, I mean, he's been away from China for a while, but it's pervasive. It's ubiquitous. It's everywhere in China, too.
It's everywhere in both countries. And I don't mean to pick on the two of them. This is what I wrote the book about. But it's ubiquitous in many countries around the world.
Some would argue here.
So, but, you know, it's actually not as ubiquitous here. That is actually different. Let me say one quick word about Indian women, because I do have this line that it's one of the worst democracies in which to be a woman. That is not because the right laws aren't on the books. They are. India is a democracy. It has a constitution that is in part modeled on ours. There are great laws on the books protecting women. However, for the poor and the low caste, they are mostly not enforced. Yeah. And so there's a very interesting story. It's a very truly Indian tale where there is so much domestic violence in these villages that a group of women got together. They call themselves the Gulabi Gang. They wear hot pink saris. And now every time they hear about someone beating up on their wives, they walk around with sticks and they go beat up on the guy.
You can go to our archives and find a whole hour on them. We did
Good.
A whole hour on them.
That's great.
Let me read a few more comments here and get your response, especially to this one from a listener. It says, the fact is China has a problem when it comes to South China Sea, devaluing their currency and cyber attacks. India, no. In other words, I think what they're saying is India doesn't have these kind of problems like China has in the South China Sea, or they're not trying to devalue currency, or they're not trying to do cyber attacks, separation between those two countries.
Right. India has a lot of problems, especially internal ones. We've talked about income inequality. We haven't talked much about the environmental problems, but they are staggering in India. And both of these countries, we tend to see them, especially China, as you know, sometimes it's characterized as out to get us. They're in a defensive crouch, just like we seem to these days be in a defensive crouch. So China's economic slowdown is having real impact, especially on its manufacturing class and its blue-collar workers, just like the problems you see here. So something leaked a few months ago where China says they're going to lay off 5 million coal and steel workers just in the next year or two. That is a huge number of people for the economy.
I know what they're
going to
do about all those people, really.
I mean,
the mine reels. Here's another question. This is sort of the Joe Biden approach to Iraq. Frame it as listener writes: China and India are not perpetual monoliths. What about either or both breaking up along regional ethnic boundaries?
Oh, that is a very interesting question. Of course, this is exactly what China in particular is terrified of. The Tibetan Autonomous Region, the Uyghurs in Western China that we talked about.
They want Tibet just the same way they wanted Hong Kong, really. I mean, for all practical purposes.
It's part of being
China, Greater
the Middle
China.
Kingdom,
yeah.
And being Greater China. India also has a lot of – India has – multiple religions, dozens of different languages. There, of course, was a breakup of India in 1949 when they became independent. It's called Pakistan and Bangladesh. And some other princely states in the middle that were forcibly absorbed into India. It's less of a problem. You don't hear much in India about regions actually breaking away. And after the crackdown on Tibet, you don't really hear much in China about regions physically breaking away from it. But it is definitely something that concerns the Chinese.
Again, our guest this hour is Anya Manuel, and she's the author of This Brave New World, India, China, and the United States. And she served in the United States State Department from 2005 to 2007, presently is a lecturer at Stanford, and will be giving a talk on Wednesday, 6:30, at the World Affairs Council. And good to have you with us this hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. We remind you that you can continue this discussion online. In fact, encourage you to do so. KQED.org/forum is a way to do that. An hour of Forum is repeated in the evening, 10 to 11. And Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Amanda Font. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Executive producer is Joanne Wallace. Our interns are Eli Wolf and Ida Mojadad. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.